On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. In the event you haven't heard enough about football...
You know, ordinarily, stadiums sit off in a way by themselves as hulking monoliths that are vacant and shut down when there's no game day. But this stadium becomes an aesthetic anchor point for an entertainment community.
That's Mayor James Butts of Inglewood. He's talking about the new NFL stadium planned for his city. So how does a building that seats 80,000 people become an aesthetic anchor point rather than a hulking monolith? We'll hear all about the thinking behind the design. And coming up, a rare Frank Lloyd Wright house in Los Angeles goes on the auction block. We'll hear its story. Back to Inglewood, where the Rams' return has the city abuzz. Could it ring in other changes? How about a long-awaited Trader Joe's? In a moment, we'll hear about the spillover effect of the new complex. First, though, to the building itself. 250 designers, planners and engineers have already been working for 18 months on the project. And I met some of the team leaders in the Westwood office of HKS Architects. Their past projects include stadiums for the Vikings and the Cowboys. Renderings and fly-throughs show a swooping transparent roof of a light plastic-based material called ETFE, covering a bowl that is sunk deep into the ground. This stadium, for Rams owner Stan Kroenke, is the crown jewel in a master plan designed by Hart Howerton with the architects and Mir Lehrer Associates for the site of the former Hollywood Park racetrack. That development, by the Hollywood Park Land Company and previously approved by the City of Inglewood, includes shops, office space, a hotel and up to 2,500 new dwellings in around 25 acres of parks and open space. The designers are likening it to a combination of LA Live and the Getty Center. First up, developers Chris Meaney and Gerard McCullum.
What we have here is a 300-acre new district within LA that's formed around 25 acres of lakes and green space. And that lake is a point of intersection between what's a great retail shopping street, which will be a new center point for the southern side of the greater Los Angeles area, and then to the north, a stadium that actually has two parts. It has a seating bowl for large sporting events that holds up to 80,000 people, and immediately to its south, a performing arts venue that will hold 6,000 seats. And those two venues share a really dramatic public plaza that opens onto the lake, and they're all covered by what will be, I think, one of the most identifiable large organic forms, a wave that covers them all, a clear roof that will be the signature point of this new entertainment district of LA.
When we first started working on the entitlements of the site, and of the over 200 community charrettes and meetings that we had, one of the key elements that the community wanted was a homage or preservation to the original lakes that were inside the actual plaza.
I just want to point out that this is a wonderful opportunity where community wishes meets the vision of the Kroenke Group. When we would sit in design meetings, JJ, Mark, I, Gerard, and we'd be talking with Stan Kroenke, one of the things that he kept coming back to is that 300 acres of land was a really precious opportunity to create a whole district, and that what he wanted to do was a place that would work on all cylinders so that it was activated 365 days a year, so that it would be a whole draw beyond just a sports stadium.
The notion that the Rams' new home should do more than host football a few Sundays a year is part of a growing trend in stadium design. It has to do with the need for stadiums to do more for the urban environment than be that hulking monolith, and with the changing ways people are watching football, as in at home, on their screens. Over to Mark Williams and Lance Evans, architects, and Kush Parekh, landscape designer.
The big design move that we did in the seating bowl, if you just look at the seating bowl, is we have really immersed the patron into technology. So you're going to have multiple views. No matter what direction you look, you are going to be connected. There's the opportunity to really have unlimited content. So I may sit there, watch live action on the field, watch live action on an HD screen, watch replays, watch every other NFL game that's going on, watch stats, fantasy football, all that stuff, you know, and maybe even other things. So it's really limitless, but all of that can happen while I'm sitting in my seat inside this venue.
Wow, so it's multitasker's delight.
It is, you know, and that's exactly the response. Design response is exactly to the multitasking and the way, right or wrong, the way that a lot of us function on a day-to-day basis on everything, let alone going to be entertained.
So this brings us back to this roof. So the roof is functioning as a cover and it's functioning as a screen. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, it does both. It's a protection element from climatic conditions. At the same time, you know, we know that 38 million people a year are going to fly and have an incredible view of, on top of this roof from airplanes. And we want to take advantage, and we're looking at how we leverage this component so that it does become one of the most visible billboards, you know, in the region.
Lance?
There are two main reasons that drove the form of this building. And one was, you know, our adjacency to LAX. And so we have a height restriction that we have to maintain. And what that did in the beginning, I think we all as designers were kind of viewing that as a big kind of concern and activity. But as we developed this, what it allowed us to do was embed our building into the landscape, not unlike what we've seen at Dodger Stadium or the Getty or the Hollywood Bowl, into this environment, and allowed us to create a really low-sung roof for this venue.
And the building goes down 100 feet, is that right?
Yes, 100 feet in the ground. You know, typically what we've been doing on, you know, our NFL stadiums in the past with Cowboys and Vikings is we go in the ground around 50 feet, and the buildings are around 300 feet tall just because of the way the NFL structures their seating bowls. So what this allowed us to do was actually, you know, reduce that to about half.
And does all the parking go down 100 feet as well?
Now, there are some parking spaces in the building, but most of the parking is, you know, surrounded on the site for phase one. And as future phases, you know, as sites get developed, we'll be developing, you know, parking structures with those.
Because that is one of the critiques of stadiums. They bring with them just miles of parking.
Yeah, well, I actually am going to give this one to Kush and Chris, because I think what we've defined here is, you know, they're not parking lots. I don't think we consider these things as parking lots, but they're actually extensions of the park. And so, Kush, you want to?
We approach them in a way that are not regular parking lots, but areas where people can come and picnic, just like the stadium, 365 days a year. There's going to be canopies where they can sit down and tailgate. Some of the parking lots are going to be used as tree nurseries, so the trees can then be removed and relocated somewhere else when development happens.
I just jump in and say that we want parking to be delivered in a way that does not take from our experience of actually the place, the urban place and the open space. So we've located the majority of our parking lots on the north side of the property between the forum and the stadium so that people can go and have that traditional tailgating experience that you sought. But we haven't let them just be blacktop parking lots. They are enriched with landscaping and shade structures and a whole bunch of pieces of the sustainable puzzle that we seek to address. And what that left us to do is leave the southern half of the site, which is interwoven with parking as well, but is a series of pedestrian pathways that link retail, hotels, public gardens, NFL studios, we hope, all to this stadium so that yes, you can get here easily. Yes, you can easily park. But that parking will be subservient to the experience of the real public realm.
You heard from Chris Meaney, Kush Parekh, Lance Evans, Mark Williams, and Gerard McCullum of the Development, Architecture, and Landscape and Planning teams for the new NFL stadium in Inglewood. This is DNA, and I'm Frances Anderton. In talking with the designers, I heard them compare the complex to the Getty Center and to LA Live. And that has some people asking if the whole complex might wind up being a self-contained destination unconnected to the rest of Inglewood. Callie Nikitas is Arts Commissioner at Large for the City of Inglewood, and she says she came in with low expectations for the design until she saw it last summer.
I was really, sincerely impressed. I think the design is great, but I think it's incredibly mindful of the community that it's going to affect, because it's not just the stadium, unlike something like Soldiers Field. You know, it includes this performing arts center, restaurants, stores, an unbelievable outdoor environment.
So how about that community that it's going to affect? Erin Aubrey Kaplan is a longtime Inglewood resident, and she's a journalist and essayist for KCET who's followed football's return with skepticism. We met at the edge of the Hollywood Park site, which currently sits empty, arid, and vast. Aubrey Kaplan's concerns start with the process itself.
On one hand, it is fantastic. I will say it's almost too good to be true. On the other hand, I'm worried about how it all came about. The whole project, when the stadium came on, the whole thing was fast-tracked through City Council. There was no vote put to the voters. And so there was no citizen input. There was no environmental impact review. And I worry about that.
Mayor James Butts has been on a fast track to turn around the City of Inglewood since he took office 5 years ago, after previously serving as chief of police in Santa Monica and then head of security at LAX. I met him at his office in downtown Inglewood and found a muscled Paul who deflects naysayers like a running back shakes off tackles.
First of all, the original project, the mixed-use development, absent the stadium and the 6,000-seat performing arts theater, that had gone through an extensive EIR process, and in fact, one of the alternatives included an NFL specification stadium. Now, as far as the public being brought into it, the original project was culminated in about 250 community meetings about that other part. And as far as the stadium, that was a citizens' initiative that was vetted citywide at a number of community meetings, and it obtained over 22,000 signatures in less than 30 days in support of it.
But Erin Aubrey Kaplan is also worried, based on past experience, that the rest of the city won't benefit.
Cross Street is the Forum, which has been renovated and doing pretty well, by the way. It's now a complete music venue, but it used to be, of course, it housed the Lakers. The Lakers were there for, since I think, almost 40 years. This was sort of built for them. It's a Laker temple. It was here when the Lakers were at their height. We also had the LA Kings, another sports franchise, and it created quite a bit of traffic and people, but people came in and out. There was no real benefit to the city of Inglewood.
Back to Mayor Butts. He says there was tons of traffic with the Forum and the racetrack, and the city managed it just fine and will do so again when the Sunday football games happen. Plus, he adds,
the Forum in its heyday with 60 home games, Laker games, the Kings games, across the street from Hollywood Racetrack, which had been here for 75 years, between the two of them, they probably added $2.5 million to the general fund. That's to put that in perspective, that's pays for over 25 police officers. So to say that that didn't contribute to the community is an amazing statement. Then think about the impact on community pride and identity being home to the world champion Lakers was, and to have a professional hockey team playing here, and to have Seattle SLU and Triple Crown race winners running here to crowds of 38 to 41,000. And then when you talk about, you worry about, this won't do anything for the city. So you're talking about basically a $5 billion development. That, do you think that someone's going to invest $5 billion in the totality of this development with the expectation it's not going to make any money? And the fact that the city is paying nothing at all to construct this and will only reap the benefits of taxes.
That's Inglewood's Mayor James Butts. The plan doesn't involve a direct public subsidy, but there is a provision for tax rebates to reimburse the landowner for public infrastructure costs if annual revenues exceed $25 million. The city covers public safety at games. There's also a study now underway at Metro into a possible connection to the stadium from the Green Line or the Crenshaw Line that would be put forward in the next county-wide bond measure. Callie Nikitas, Arts Commissioner at Large for Inglewood, moved to the city 8 years ago. She lives in the north, more affluent neighbourhood. She teaches at Otis College of Art and Design, and she understands that she's a participant in a changing city. She says the stadium is having a galvanising effect.
It's put Inglewood on the map in a really wonderful, refreshing way. One of the conversations that's been going on is how do we shift the perceptions of Inglewood that people on the outside have. What I know of Inglewood, or actually knew of Inglewood before I moved here, is really not close to the reality or my reality as an Inglewood resident. So with the stadium now on a national, if not international, stage, people are really talking about it, seeing Inglewood in a different light. You know, some people are for, some people are not. But there is a lot of dialogue, and my experience has been very positive.
Then there's the G word. Back to Erin Aubrey Kaplan.
Well, I will say, I'll do my little plug here. Inglewood is a great place. It is not far from the ocean. It's well located. So I have nothing but good things to say about it. But if the world, quote unquote, discovers Inglewood, will it then gentrify? And, you know, that means changing the population. That means less black and brown people, more white people. And it seems to me from a real estate standpoint, that's the only way things actually improve. And that, you know, that's a bigger question. It's a bigger issue that, again, is not the responsibility of a developer. But it just tends to happen. It's happening in other parts of the city. It's happening in Crenshaw, for example. And so you have this bigger question of the displacement of populations. I've been here a long time. I'd like to see stay here to reap the benefits of whatever transformation happens. Will I be priced out? I don't know. I would hope that that I want the improvements to come. I want the property values to rise, but hopefully not without whole-scale gentrification.
Over to Mayor Butts again.
So let's talk about gentrification. So what is gentrification? It's when upper middle class people move into an area and they buy up formerly distressed properties, and now those distressed properties are no longer low income. Well, what's been happening since 2012 and continues to happen is that upper middle class people of all races are coming to buy middle class and upper middle class properties here at a price or greater price than what people are asking for them. That is no different than in the 60s when African Americans that were upper middle class came and bought properties in upper middle class areas like Morningside Park and at the price that people were asking for them. So I fail to understand this thing about gentrification. It doesn't matter the race of people that come and purchase. That's just the way life is. But we will always have a percentage of new housing developments that are built affordable if we're going to use, you know, federal and state subsidies to subsidize housing. So those percentages will continue. But the reality is that what's happening here is we're having people buy into our better neighborhoods.
One of the byproducts of investment in Inglewood that is widely hoped for is an improvement in its local schools. But there's something else that seems to be on a lot of minds.
Yeah, where's that Trader Joe's? Trader Joe's, I just use it as a metaphor for, you know, I guess improvement. It's funny, it's not a luxury store. It's not like it's you know, Van Cleef and Arpels or something. But somehow Trader Joe's is a symbol of stability and desirability in a neighborhood. So I suppose we would like to be courted by Trader Joe's. And this has been around for 20 years. I've heard people in South Central Inglewood say, why don't we have our Trader Joe's? Everybody in Southern California has one. Why don't we?
Trader Joe's is a bit of the great equalizer because it serves a number of communities. There are so many all over Los Angeles, and there currently isn't one, to my knowledge, in the city of Inglewood. And I do look for us to have a Trader Joe's because I actually see my neighbors shopping at the Trader Joe's in Westchester. And that's the case, quite honestly. I see my neighbors at Whole Foods. I see my neighbors eating in restaurants in Culver City and Beverly Hills, wherever. We are not yet experiencing the city of Inglewood the way we will be experiencing it.
It turns out Mayor Butts has good news.
In fact, I know that Trader Joe's wants to come to the development that we have the negotiating agreement for right now by Thomas Safran Associates at the Market and Florence site. It used to be a Buffett and Cadillac dealership across the street from the Metro station. It'll be first floor retail, over 177 units of housing. So fear not, Trader Joe's is on the way.
That was Mayor James Butts of the City of Inglewood concluding our look at the proposed new NFL stadium. According to the designers, earth-moving equipment will start digging the 100-foot-deep hole for the stadium this coming August. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. After this break, a rare Frank Lloyd Wright house goes on the auction block.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
$1,100 has been now to $1,200. $1,100 I have now to $1,200. $1,200 to $1,300.
That's the voice of Peter Lockery, auctioneer. 24 years ago, he founded Los Angeles Modern Auctions, specializing in 20th century design and art. The first piece he ever auctioned was a Frank Lloyd Wright window. Now, he's getting to sell an entire house by the famed architect.
This one was designed in 1939 for an aerospace engineer named George Sturgis. It's referred to as the George Sturgis residence for that reason, and it is very similar to one of his most famous houses on water. In fact, it has a very broad, deep overhanging cantilever, which resembles some of the ideas first organized in the Falling Water design.
To your knowledge, did George Sturgis see the drawings for Falling Water and say, I'd like that too? Or was his the test house for Falling Water?
No, actually, Falling Water was started earlier. Falling Water was made for a very wealthy patron, and it had been started several years earlier. But as it was being completed, George Sturgis reached out to Frank Lloyd Wright and wanted a more modest house on a budget for a middle-class family. And the house that was created was, in fact, a kind of compact, small study for a cantilever design.
By middle class, what we mean is the house cost $11,000 or thereabouts to build, plus $10 for the spacious hillside site in the Brentwood district of LA.
But in 1939, $11,000 was a lot more than what most middle class families could afford.
So this house is really fascinating because it really embodies stories of people. It's a Frank Lloyd Wright design, but much of the work was executed by one of LA's most admired mid-century architects. Who was that?
So John Lautner, who went on to become very well known in the Los Angeles architectural circles, was working as an apprentice for Frank Lloyd Wright in the late 1930s. And this was the first project that Frank Lloyd Wright let him run from start to finish.
So John Lautner, whose works include, for example, Silvertop and the Chemosphere House in the Hills, he himself, an extraordinarily inventive designer, John Lautner revered Frank Lloyd Wright. To his own death, he always referred to him as Mr. Wright. And he took great pride in this Sturgis house. Is that right?
Yeah, he did. He learned quite a lot about it. And in fact, the same year, he started designing a house for himself here in Los Angeles and settled here, I believe, because of the Sturgis house. Anyone who has seen the dramatic Chemosphere house, of this house that's sort of perched on top of a pole overlooking the San Fernando Valley, should immediately recognize the sort of archetype of a large structure protruding out from a hillside.
For sure. Balanced almost precariously and seeming as if it's sort of flying, but flying and kind of heavy and rooted all at the same time.
Yeah, I think in 1939, they were using steel and wood to a very dramatic effect. And, you know, 30 years later, he was able to create much more dramatic effects. I think Lautner always went for the dramatic.
So the house is built by George Sturges, but its most recent owners have their own story. Tell us who they were.
In 1967, a couple named Jim Bridges and Jack Larson purchased the house and, in fact, hired John Lautner to restore it. And Jack Larson was perhaps best known as portraying Jimmy Olsen in the original Adventures of Superman television show in the 1950s. And Jim Bridges was a very well-known director who directed, among many films, Bright Lights, Big City, The China Syndrome, and Urban Cowboy.
And they lived very openly as a gay couple, and they loved that house with a passion and worked on it over the years. Is that correct?
Yeah, they restored the house in 1972, and they were perhaps one of the best owners the house could have had, because in a time when architecture was being sort of forgotten or altered in the 70s and 80s, they really struggled but kept the house as original as possible for all this time.
I think it's fair to say that much as Frank Lloyd Wright's houses are admired, they are also known for not always being the most comfortable of houses, because he was a bit dictatorial about how every element of the house should conform to his design, and sometimes the furniture wasn't that comfortable and so on. That's sort of part of the Frank Lloyd Wright kind of story. But Jack and Jim, they were very comfortable in this house.
They were. In fact, they lived there. They were comfortable because they lived the way Frank Lloyd Wright imagined someone should live in the house. It's a fairly humble house, and there's no room really for extravagant features. So if you're the type of person who can live simply, you can be very comfortable in a house like the Sturges residence.
Now, why is the house being auctioned and not sold in a regular way?
Well, in fact, it's sort of a hybrid of both. The house is being represented by Sotheby's International Realty as well. And Barry Sloan is one of the top agents who specializes in architectural significant properties. And by working together, we believe that we will get the ideal owner and also get the highest price for the foundation that's been set up.
For a couple of weeks, people are going to be able to see around the house. Is that right? Who might be interested in buying?
Yeah, the house is open by appointment now for prospective buyers. And it really is an opportunity to sort of live inside a work of art. But, you know, it'll have challenges. The property needs some restoration. But we think the right owner will have a wonderful next 50 years in the house, just like Jack and Jim did.
We should add that you are a regular advisor on the Antiques Roadshow. Here you've got a very, let's just say, a sizable antique here.
Yes, something like this has never walked into the roadshow, that's for sure.
Well, Peter Lockery, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Francis.
The estimated sale price for the Sturges house is $2.5 to $3 million. The 1,200 square foot building is a historic cultural monument, so it cannot be altered or torn down. Funds from the sale will go to the Bridges Larson Foundation, supporting higher education, arts and culture. The auction takes place on February 21st and the house can be viewed through February 19th. Go to our website for more details. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. But I'll be on the road later this week, along with Evan Kleiman, host of Good Food. We'll be talking about the role food and dining plays these days in urban design. That's at a conference called Taste, taking place this Friday at the LA Theatre Centre. There'll be some great speakers there, among them Mark Bittman, Ron Finley, Ricardo Salvador and Alyssa Walker. Check our website for details. Today's show was produced by Gideon Brow and mixed by Ray Guana. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Find more DNA on our blog at kcrw.com/DNA blog and follow us on our Facebook page at KCRW DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Thank you very much for listening.